still the interviewing
the victim. Let's go back to the weapon. At some fixed point, you went back to your room to get your weapon.
Right.
And when you went to get the paper, you left your weapon with Weatherman.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
All right. How did your weapon get back to your room?
It was another time before I knew that I was going to be maintaining custody for the duration of the detainee being in our compound. That's why I said I needed to put this thing away.
And okay. When the detainee came and was put into your custody, did you have your weapon?
Yes.
Okay. You had your sidearm and you had your rifle.
Yes.
All right. When you took the detainee into the screening room, did you have your both weapons?
Yes.
All right. How did your weapon get back to your room?
I brought it back.
Why?
Because I don't want to have a rifle with me the whole time I was watching.
Okay.
There's no need for it. It just took up one of my hands.
All right. And is this after you left your rifle with Weatherman or before?
After.
All right. Now, at some point, you come back and you're saying, where's this McCabe and Keith are in there with the detainee? Tell us what you see. You walk in, what do you see?
I walk in, and I could just sense that there was something going on.
What do you mean?
It was just weird. I can't describe the feeling in there, but there's no reason for those two guys to be in there. I've never seen them back there before. McCabe told me that he was certain. So, in my head, I knew what was going on.
Okay, so McCabe told you he being detained?
Yes, he said he's certain right now. He's certain. We're all sitting there looking at him. The detainee was in the chair at that point.
What was the detainee doing?
Just sitting in the chair, kind of like hunched over a little bit.
Right. Did he, was he making noise?
No.
Where was Weatherman?
I think he was outside.
Right, so who had custody of this guy at this point?
It would have been, when I left the custody with Weatherman, he stood outside the whole time. And people were just going in and out. And now I know why he did it, because he's in the clear now. I mean, he's not at this one, and we're actually with him. He can say, hey, I think I have a strong feeling of what went on, but I didn't see anything. So he's in the clear. Now those guys hate him like they hate me now. You know what I mean?
So you have knowledge that Weatherman was, when he was supposed to be watching this guy, he was outside.
Right.
Okay. Was he supposed to be outside?
No, if you take custody of someone, they should be in your sight at all times.
And you think Weatherman was consciously avoiding witnessing what was going on?
He knows. I got kind of thrown into the fire, he knows. He's been stationed with these guys before. He knows where they are. He knows what goes on in that situation.
Have you ever heard of someone before?
No, not yet. None of our other detainees were abused. But
so, what do you mean by
you want me to jump ahead a little bit?
Yeah.
When I saw McCabe hit him, his thing fell to the floor, I noticed that there was blood coming out of his mouth. I walked outside immediately, even though that three guys were in there, and I said, Daddy, I said, he's bleeding. And he goes, I know, man. He said, there's nothing that you can say or do that are going to change these guys. And he started telling me about, when he first got to, this attachment, he was a fighter. He was guarding the other SEAL team's detainees. And he said that those guys, beat them up. And he said he could see the Connex boss, going back and forth. I guess the doors would have been closed, and he could see the Connex boss rocking back and forth. So.
Right. Well, on this occasion, when you come back, Weatherman's outside. Okay, you walk into
right.
The box.
I remember having a discussion with Weatherman that he had to go back to his little medical hut to get the paperwork because I didn't have it.
Okay.
So that might have been the time where he left, and then, the three individuals were in there. But at the same time, I remember coming out.
Well, where was Weatherman when you came back and you saw these three guys in there in the screen with the detainee? Where was Weatherman?
I can't swear that he was out there at that time, but I can swear that as soon as I witnessed the abuse, I walked out and I saw him, and he was out there.
Right. So, you at one particular point, you walk in, and the detainee is kind of sitting in a chair, hunched over a little bit, not making any noise. Okay, not bouncing back and forth as if he's in pain.
No.
Okay, so you simply see nothing to let you think this guy had been abused at this point.
No physical evidence, no.
Okay. Lighting in this facility is good.
It was just like this. We had generators up there.
Right. So, McCabe says to you he's hurting now?
Yeah, he's hurt, yeah.
And where is Werther's and where is Keith while this comment made?
Right next to him.
Okay, and where are they from the detainee? How far away are they from the detainee?
About the same distance. Yeah, at this point, you know, I remember going
same
in.
Same distance, we're separated right here?
Right.
4 feet?
Maybe even closer, I'd say about 2.5 feet.
Okay, detainee's still sitting down.
Right, at this point, I don't know if I went outside again, or I remember walking back, because I never actually saw him physically lift up the detainee. I remember coming back in, and the detainee was already standing.
Alright. How long were you outside?
It would have been seconds. Because I do not remember seeing
that. You walk outside.
Just because, you know, I was still talking to Patty or HM1 Weatherman and stuff like that. It's just, since I've been a little kid, I was obviously scared at this point. I knew I had a very good inkling of what was going on. And, you know, when something like that's going on in my head, it's like my instinct to pace back and forth. Like, standing still, I have a hard time with doing it, so I like to walk back and forth just to, like, sit there and collect my thoughts. But it would have been like I stepped outside and I stepped right back in. Because I never saw them grab the detainee and lift him up. I never saw that.
So when you come back in, you're outside for a very short period of time,
less than a minute.
So you come back in, the detainee is now standing?
He's standing. Where are the guys? McCabe was close to me. And of course, it's next to him, and then Keith was in the back.
Alright, and what was said or done at that point? Anything?
Nothing was said. The detainee was standing there, and as soon as I walked in, I kind of looked around a little bit, and that's when McCabe threw the punch.
Alright, and the detainee was standing there, did it appear at that particular point before you saw the punch that he was in pain, swaying, was he
moaning or groaning, nothing.
Alright, so you walk in, and you see McCabe punch him.
Yes, William. He was like a right hook.
To where?
On his body. In the stomach, yeah. It was like the lower, it was right hook, so he hit him like right here.
One punch.
One punch.
What did he pain he do?
He fell.
Alright,
he fell. He didn't hear like,
bend over, he literally fell.
And he like that, and then he fell over. It wasn't like, boom, like hard hit the ground. It was like, he hunched over, fell really slowly like that.
To his right side.
To his right side.
Okay, what did McCabe and, I'm sorry, what did Horthus and Keith do?
They started laughing. You know, just the whole time when McCabe actually did it. McCabe and I were really good friends when it happened, and I know the only reason he did this was to be one of the guys. He would have never done this under any other circumstances. You know, when he punched him, he looked hesitant. Like, he just kind of looked like he's a new SEAL, and that was just the way of proving himself. Because if everyone else was beating him up, and he wasn't, they would have looked at him like he was up.
What are these guys, did anybody say anything to him?
Yes, I still get it. At this point, the detainee's on the ground. Keithy went outside, and he got, there's like a log out there, like this big, and he was just making a lot of noises, and he stood over the detainee, and he just like growled, like made like a roar, like rah, like that, just trying to fight him out. But I never saw any other kind of movie that he's filming.
The blow is given by McCabe. This guy goes down the ground. Is he down on his knees?
No, he's laying on the side. He's laying like
laying on the side. Okay. Horthus and Keith are still in that room.
Yes.
Does anybody say anything to you at this particular point?
Yes. They saw me and they knew that I was, you know, I was pretty scared, and they he looked up at me and he said, don't feel bad for this guy. And then Horthus chimed in and said, no, this guy killed a lot of Americans, including two team guys.
Alright, so the communications were by McCabe and Horthus. Keith did not say anything.
McKeithy and Horthus.
Okay,
McCabe never said.
Okay, so this Keith said this. Okay. And then you left again? You went out of the room?
I picked him up. Those guys left. I picked him up and sat him in the chair.
All right. At that particular point, did you, obviously you're not communicating with him and such, do you see any physical injuries to him?
Yes, just the blood coming out of his mouth. I don't
see the blood coming out of his mouth. He's got a hood on.
Well, he was lying on the side.
Okay.
And the hood comes down to like, right, it doesn't actually cover his mouth.
Okay.
Because I always remember like being able to see their teeth, but he was sitting there like this, and then like small amounts of blood were were coming out. I mean, unless McCabe punched him so hard it's making him bleed from his stomach, McCabe wasn't responsible for that. Unless he hit his face on the way down.
But he slumped over pretty slowly.
Slumped pretty slowly. And I don't think that even if he was, you're not going to let your head lead when you're falling down. You know he's going down. Well, you're going to leave your head up like that. And that's the way he fell.
Right. Did you see the source of the blood? Was it just a cut lip or was it?
It was the cut lip, and it was like on the inside. Like if you were looking at it on the left side of his mouth.
It's just something that could have been done by himself, and he could have cut it off.
He could have.
Clearly,
if you really want to bite your lip that hard, you're that motivated, you could have done the damage you need to do.
So he fell on his right shoulder?
Yes.
And the cut was on his left lip. Left side of his lip?
His right shoulder, and you got a cut on the bottom lower right lip.
Right, but if you're looking at him, it's like on the left side of his face.
Okay. Alright.
So his right, yeah, so if you put it this way, yeah.
Okay, now you say somebody's cleaning him up, or cleaning it up?
That happened two different times.
Okay, what do you mean by that, cleaning
it up? That's when I went outside, the guys left, I went outside, and I called Agent 1 Weather Magaddy, as we all call him, okay. Magaddy, I think, bleeding. And that's when the whole conversation went on about how he'd seen this dude before. You know, I've been in 20 years. He said, I've got too much to risk on this. And I said, you know, I told him how nervous I was. And, you know, he told me that there's nothing I can say or do that's going to change these guys. So we went in, and that's when we started doing, like, the more detailed medical screening.
We, it's you and Weatherman.
Right. I mean, he was doing it. I was just, whenever that guy was left, you had to have positive control over
him. Okay.
You know, so they don't. And it's a self-inflicted injury.
So now Weatherman takes the mask off of him?
He lifted it up. And, you know, he saw the source where the blood was coming from, and he told me that he was going to do his best to clean it up for me.
All right.
At the time, I'd already dribbled onto his gown a little bit.
Okay. Now, you see, Horthus, McCabe, and Keith, they leave?
Yes. And then Horthus said, that's enough for now, we'll come back later.
What do you want to do?
At that point, it seemed like not too long after that, that's when I saw, you know, Fifi, or not, Free, and Higby would come back again, and it's on the Lieutenant Higby Free. And they came back, and I knew that, you know, that I was going to be the one, that this is when I decided to take my rifle back. So it was those guys. I'm pretty sure, I don't know if Patty left at that exact moment, but I know he was Mr. Free, which is, he's our assistant officer in charge, and then Higby was back in there again. And
you were in there with him at all times?
No, I was never in there with him.
Okay, why, if you know that you just had a detainee who was in your custody, but abused, why are you leaving with somebody who you thought was a real
detainee? It was getting to the point where I knew it was wrong, and I quit that, you know, to HM1, and, you know, he told me, not that I didn't know any better, but, you know, it wasn't very, didn't give me any confidence by him telling me, hey, this is the way it is, you know. This is the way it is. You know, I know what's wrong. It's just the way these guys are.
Did you and the HM1 make a conscious decision at that particular point not to report that?
Well, it was never, it's not an option to report. You don't do it. And I mean,
so you made the decision not to report it?
I never made the decision because obviously I did. But I mean, who do you report it to?
Where?
But who do you report it to when your LPO is in on it? Your assistant officer in charge in there, you know?
Okay, I'm going to turn it on now.
He was busy doing all that stuff. And I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. It's not a decision that you make that easy. No, I mean, look at the position I'm in now, with all the media and stuff like that. It's not a decision that was easy. I really cared about these guys. You know, like, they were my buddies. And, like, the DTP and the caveman that killed, you know, horses is another story. The DTP and the caveman killed me, those guys are my friends. And, I mean...
Well, how did you feel about this detainee?
I mean, he's worth it. I mean, he's a dirtbag. I mean, look what he's done to, you know...
Okay, how do you feel about what he's done to the Americans?
It's horrible. I mean, it's horrendous. I mean, it's one of the worst events that took place in the whole war.
Did you ever have any thoughts about hitting him yourself or getting a shot in at him?
No. Because, I mean, that's wrong. I mean, it doesn't matter how I feel about it. You know, I have the rules that I have to abide by.
Okay, well, you have a bunch of rules to abide by.
Right.
Maintain your weapon, maintain security of this guy. He does not do that. Right?
Right.
Okay. You have military duty to do all this shit, right?
Yes.
Okay, how do we know you didn't pop a guy?
There's no way to know. Unless you talk to him. I had him for the last part. The
well, how the hell, when you say talk to him, talk to the detainee?
Right.
How the hell does the detainee know who's him?
He doesn't, but if you can tell him, none of those guys are going to say, you know, unless they're going to lie about it, they're going to say that they finally hit him, because I did. You know, and that's the scary part for me. That was another thing I had to consider. You know, who's going to believe me? One dispensable master arms in the Navy, when a bunch of Navy SEALs, you know, war heroes.
Yeah, other than your work, what do we have to show us that you deny him?
There is nothing. Because I was the only one back there. It's just me telling the truth. I never hit that guy. And but there's, I mean, I know it's an unfortunate situation because I don't have a witness.
Okay, but if you didn't hit him, then why did you, once Lieutenant Neal comes around asking what the hell's going on here, why don't you tell Lieutenant Neal?
Because at that point, I mean, it was still, I knew what the right thing to do was, but... I know who these guys are. I saw guys get roughed over there, roughed up, like our own American guys, they got roughed up for doing far less than, you know, putting these guys' career on the line. You know, and that's something I have to live with for the rest of my life. If you guys get in any kind of trouble, I'm going to have to watch over my shoulders my entire life, you know?
You saw American
service members roughed up. I didn't see it firsthand, but it was well known, it occurred, you know, just like small things. Like, guys would eat, you know, we had to build a little kitchen back there.
Uh-huh.
One guy ate out of somebody's food. Okay, uh-huh. You don't do it, whatever, you know, talk crap to you, whatever.
Uh-huh.
They went in and, like, grabbed him by his neck, out of his bed, and, like, drug him out and put him on the ground.
Who grabbed him by his neck?
Higby grabbed him by his neck. So knowing Higby was involved, I mean, that guy has no limits.
You know,
some of the things that came out of his mouth, he would, no doubt, take care of him.
Okay, and the person they grabbed and dragged out was a non-SEAL.
Yes.
Okay.
And he was,
who was that?
He was an IS-2, and he was a dirtbag too. I mean, he actually stole from one of the
IS-2,
Broberg, B-R-O-B-E-R-G.
Sorry, one more time.
B-R-O-B-E-R-G.
B-E-R-G, Broberg, oh yeah, IS-2, right, so. To get back on the thing we did real quickly, so you had cleaned him up, you and Weatherman had cleaned him up.
Yeah.
Okay, you put him back in his chair. back, because that's where you're maintaining the watch, right?
I think we might have gone back outside.
Yeah, okay, so you step back outside. Then what happens?
That's when I saw Lieutenant Free and Higby walking up.
And at that point, Weatherman splits?
He takes off, I think so.
And do you say to Higby or Free, hey, you guys got him?
They knew. I said, hey, I'm going to put my rifle away.
Okay, I'm going to put my rifle away, and you walk away.
But
at that point in your mind, you're thinking, they're going to go in there and rough him up.
Yes.
And you believe that Lieutenant Free was involved in going in and kicking him. Okay, so you put your rifle away. Go ahead.
What would make you think that Lieutenant Free was
involved? It's another thing that I brought up to NCIS. When I was walking away, I heard, you know, it sounded like a grunt or a moan or something like that.
They probably got it, too.
Yes.
Okay, yes. So then you go back to your room. You heard grunt or moan. You go back to your room, you secure your rifle.
Yes.
Which you did, how you did that? Is that the wire through it to the bed?
But then,
put the wire through it and attach it to the rifle. How did you secure the rifle?
I put it in my room. And
yes.
Yes. It's just different, I'm telling you.
Well, where did you put your round? Where did you put your ammo?
In my room.
Okay.
Right, that's what everybody did, because at this point, our compound wasn't secure anymore. The Marines pulled out. We had Iraqis, so like right over our wall was outside the wire. So in the event that we were starting to get mortared or something like that, we had to have our weapons and ammunition present in case we had to defend our combat.
Okay, but not home yet, in your room.
In my room, yeah.
Okay. So you leave the room and you immediately go from your room back to the Connex box.
No, I went to the TAR.
You went to the where?
The Tactical Operations Center.
Okay.
And I just talked to Ensign Heiss, or Lieutenant G.G. Heiss, and I said, you know, just clarify, hey, we're not doing any paperwork on guy, anything like that. He said, no, I walked back. That's when I went back to the Connex box.
And when you get there, who's there?
Only Lieutenant Free.
Okay, so Higby's gone. Lieutenant Free gone.
Because I remember coming in and seeing him leaning against, like, the partition, like a little set of the fighters.
Lieutenant Free, yes. Okay, what was the thing you did on when you came back?
Sitting there still.
Now, when you came back in, did you, was there any way for someone to see you coming back in?
No, it's just because it's all sand out there. It's pretty quiet.
One sec.
It's to the left and it's up there.
Where are we?
We're gonna. Okay.
You came back in and freed him. How far is Free from the detainee?
2 feet.
He's leaning on that little piece of plywood.
Oh, that really, yeah. He was leaning on it like this, and you just kind of, he was just looking at him.
What kind of do you think that Higby and Lieutenant?
Yes. I there was something going on. Higby, for sure. Lieutenant Freed. He's definitely aware of it. I don't know. I can't swear. And that's just another reason why the special agent told me
that. This is a taking point. When Lieutenant O'Neill comes in and asks you to lay your point about 0800, what happened? Okay, you at this particular point have information. You personally saw McCabe take a shot at him. And you honestly believe, based upon what you heard and what you saw, that Higby and Lieutenant had abused this guy.
Yes.
Okay. You were asked by Lieutenant O'Neill what happened to this guy.
Right.
You lied to Lieutenant.
Yes.
And you lied to cover it up.
Yes.
Right.
Well, I mean,
I know what I'm getting at. You got three SEALs going to court martial here.
Right.
What's happened to you?
Nothing.
Okay. And the reason nothing is because you're the government witness saying that you saw McCabe do this.
Right.
Okay. But we've got two other guys who are being charged with failing to report, basically.
Right.
Okay. Who else failed to report?
Me.
Okay. And who else flat out lied?
Me.
To Lieutenant. Okay. You don't think we've done anything wrong?
Yeah. By the book, yes, I did.
But by the book?
Yeah. Right. Under the circumstances, I mean.
So two guys are on the court martial court.
What part of we're busy do you not understand?
Yeah. Five.
TFB.
Yeah.
can you back up just 1 second? When you come back, we're kind of freeze leaning on the partition.
But
did you stick your head around and look at the detainee?
Well, that's when I assume the watch for the rest of the time, yeah.
Right, so you said, see you later, Lieutenant Free, or Mr. Free, or whatever,
right.
You looked in there? No, I walked in there.
You walked in.
And yeah, I sat down and I saw the detainee sitting there.
Okay, so there's actually a chair for you to sit in.
Right.
Sat behind the partition.
And you had a chair too.
And you chilled out and you just sat there until what time?
Well, what happened next? Jesse Crawford, another special operator, came in. I can't even give you a good estimate. It was quite a while after all this went down. And he popped his head in and he looked kind of surprised to see me, and he looked at the detainee. And he said, I didn't even know that we had this guy. And he shook his head a little bit, you know, when he saw the condition of the detainee, and then he walked out.
Okay, while you were waiting there, was the detainee groaning, moaning?
No.
Was he slouched over in the seat? Was he sitting in the seat?
He was slouched over, and he kept on, like trying to fall asleep, you know?
What do you mean, trying to fall asleep?
Well,
he had his mask on?
Right, and I could just see him, like, dozing off and stuff.
All right, so the guy who just been abused, you're saying, is falling asleep?
4 hours later, yes.
Right.
You could tell, you know, and I'd say, wake up, you know. And that was...
Why did you want to wake him up?
Because it's just a test that we use for, like, interrogation and stuff like that. You never... You want to keep them very uncomfortable the entire time you have them. You know, it's the same kind of techniques that are used one time a day. Just by the time they actually hit an interrogation room, they're so stressed out, they're so ready to go to sleep and all that stuff, they'll tell you anything that you want. So...
Okay, so Crawford and Nassesso showed up. Now, Crawford's an 18th alphabet. He's a medic, right?
Yes, yes.
But Crawford never did the medical eval he's got.
He was more just like a combat medic, Agent 1 Weatherman. He's an independent duty corpsman. He just did it for the whole time.
Okay, so then Crawford and Nassesso stop by. He looks in. He takes off. Then what? Then who shows up?
That's it. And then, you know, towards the end, I was starting to think, like, man, when am I going to... At this point... I had been awake probably approaching like 30 hours just because, like, whenever I got detained, I didn't sleep. Just because, you know, I was on a completely different schedule than the SEALs. I had been up for an extended period of time at this point. And I was just wondering when I was going to get relieved. So I moved him over from the screening facility to the actual...
So you moved him?
Yeah.
After Crawford and the SO came by?
Yes, I moved him over to the other facility where I could sit outside and I could still be within a distance of him and keep an eye on him. That I could also see when somebody was going to be coming to release or to pick this guy up.
Okay, so where are you moving to? Just because I'm sorry, I'm not.
It's just one Connex box. It's here, one was here. I took him outside and walked him right over in the other one.
Okay, move to other Connex box to view approaching relief.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
When were you making comments about you never going to be a highway patrol officer?
In the we had a meeting after Lieutenant O'Neill came and saw what had happened and stuff. We had a meeting. I never said I would never be a highway patrol officer. That's always been my dream my whole life and stuff.
Were you denying saying that?
I told him that, you know, I walked in there, excuse my language, I said I'm fucked. You know, because regardless of who's the one that abused them.
Who was there when you made that statement, I'm fucked?
What are you thinking that, dude? Every SEAL, I actually said it to the lady. Every SEAL was in there.
Lieutenant O'Neill had a meeting, he had everybody in there?
Right.
Alright. And so you're in there, if everybody was O'Neill there at that time?
No, not at that time.
This is when everybody's first started
right, because,
there.
You know, like you said, Lieutenant O'Neill came out, I picked up the detainee, and he was obviously covered in blood and stuff, and, you know, I'm not going to lie, I knew the whole thing was wrong. You know,
yeah, let's go back, you said a guy's covered in blood, how much blood's on him?
He had, I mean, I don't know if you guys have that gown, but there was like a...
We haven't seen jack shit yet.
Really, that's what I heard as far as all the articles and stuff like that. But if you guys can get a hold of that, there's a considerable amount of blood on there. And it's not because he was pouring blood. It's just like little drips.
It was drips.
Yeah. Right. I mean, he was never... So,
That's called a dish dash, right?
A dish dash, I believe so. And then...
Did you see anybody take pictures of him?
Before all the abuse, yes.
No, after the abuse.
No.
Nothing. No. So, you're all in this room with Lieutenant O'Neill getting everybody, we're getting together, we're having a meeting. That's basically what the fuck's going on here.
Right. I mean, he came and picked them up for me. You know, and...
You walk into this room but with all the SEALs there and you make a comment that to the effect, I'm fucked.
Yes.
In front of everybody.
Yes.
Alright. Did you make a comment about I'm never going to get to be a highway patrol?
Well, I might have said that, but I was just expressing that, hey, you know, I'm not a Navy SEAL, I don't get away with stuff like this. You know, I don't have any intention of staying in the Navy. He said, you know, something like this can ruin it for me. And I was just...
Did you feel you had a bad reputation with the
SEAL team at that point?
I said that, and I know I exactly said that. I don't know.
You said what?
Then I had better petition. Because I said...
At that same meeting?
Yeah.
But I can't afford to ever get a bad reputation.
It wasn't a bad reputation, but I definitely wasn't known as a hard worker. Because these guys weren't going out and getting bad guys. They were noted. I mean, 5 detainees in 6 months, you can only imagine how much downtime that I had. So, I mean, I wasn't... I try to find things to do. Everybody else had a job. But if, for me, if there's no detainees, there was no job. So I felt that, you know, people looked at me like I wasn't a hard worker. And that's what I meant by saying I had a bad reputation.
You said I can't get in trouble again? Because you got in trouble before when you were there?
No, I never said that.
No?
I never did.
You've never had any sort of disciplinary issue before?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm detail-oriented guy. So, you got him transferred to the other Connex box, right?
Yes.
You're hanging out outside.
Right.
You see Lieutenant O'Neill coming to get him?
Is
right.
He with the Iraqi?
No, he drove the ATV back there.
Oh, he drives the four-wheeler back,
correct?
Okay, he's parked the four-wheeler. He also has a four-wheeler.
Right.
He says what?
He says, oh, he's, you know, in a pretty good mood. And then he said, you excited to go to bed? Are you ready to go to bed? And I said, yeah, I don't even think I responded to him. And then, picked the detainee up, and he said, what's on his count? And I still didn't say anything. And he was like, is that the weather? And I still didn't say anything. And, you know, he asked me, he said, what happened here? You know, and he said, and the only thing I could say, I probably went a good 15 seconds just staring at this blank. Because this was like do or die right now. I was going to report these guys and deal with that, or I was going to go along with it, you know. And I didn't say anything. Cause
well, you decided to go along with it.
You know, the first time you thought about that?
About what?
About what you're going to say.
Right, because, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. I knew it was wrong the entire time.
But you decided to go along with it at that point.
No, I never, by not saying anything, I was going along with it. I never made the conscious decision where I was going to say, hey, I'm going to go against this, I'm going to lie, and I'm going to cover this up.
Okay.
But, you know.
Alright, so he looked at what happened here.
He said, well, what's going on, why is he quit? And that's when it got, you know, real to me, because, you know, when I saw Lieutenant DG Free out there, my LPO and all those guys, you know, I couldn't help but think, you know, it's just the way things happen with the SEAL team. You always hear about them doing stuff that, you know, you don't talk about, stuff like that. So, I knew it was wrong the entire time, but, you know, things are just different with those guys. Things happen differently, and it's just like a different operating.
So let's get back to what actually happened. So, Neil was standing there, he's asking all the questions, you said nothing.
Right, and he said, and all I could say was, there was team guys back here. And at the time, he was just so focused, you know, on the bloody lip, and he lifted up his mask a little bit, and saw that there was blood on his cheek, and that was probably just from the mask, or I don't know how that spread.
Now, fast forward for me to 13 September, you spoke to an NCIS agent, remember?
Yes.
Okay. NCIS agent asked you, what did you first see? I saw McCabe, Richards, and Keith standing 3 feet away from the detainee. Detainee was facing, standing up against the wall. He did not appear to be in any distress. Is that accurate?
Yes.
All right. What did you first hear? I did not hear anything out of the ordinary when I returned to the detainee facility. Is that accurate, or did you lie?
Out of the ordinary for what?
Well, your words. I did not hear anything out of the ordinary when I returned to the detainee facility. In other words, what the agent's asking you, what did you see when you got there and what was said? Now, you're telling us that, you know, basically at some particular point you heard McCabe or Keith make some comments.
Right, and the special agent said, you know, because I couldn't swear to it by this point, you know. I couldn't swear like the actual timeline of events. Like, what went on back there, I can tell you every single person that was back there. But, you know, there were just guys walking in and out. Like, I remember, like, Special Operator Mitchell. I remember seeing him back there, but there's no way I could tell you at what point he came back. Just because there was guys, like, in and out, just, like, you know, going in and out. I just had no control over the situation at all.
When O'Neill takes the tank Amber, does he put him on a four-wheeler?
Yes.
He drives off with him, like, sitting on the back of the four-wheeler?
And I was sitting right next to him.
Okay, a four-wheeler. You're talking about one of those...
It actually had six wheels, and it had a little flatbed in the back.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you load him up on the back by cargo, and you drive off, and you drive to where?
The front gate?
The front gate, yeah, the front gate.
And who's waiting at the front gate?
Nobody was waiting there.
at some point, Lieutenant O'Neill went and woke up toward us. And then they look and, you know, they're evaluating him more. Fortis was actually, like, cleaning up his lip and stuff. And then Lieutenant O'Neill went to go get him a new dispatch. Because I through our, like, our special operations or whatever, they have a bunch for, like, undercover stuff or whatever. So they got a new dispatch, a brown one, and during the time of Lieutenant O'Neill's effort, Fortis said, what'd you tell him? You know, and I said, you know, what you want me to tell him? He's covered in blood. And I said, and I told him I didn't think. And he went, I think Fortis actually, he brought the new dispatch out, changed him and stuff like that, cleaned his lip up as best as we could. But he still had like a white beater on underneath that still had like a few trickles of blood in it. And then we walked him outside, and the detainee, it was no secret, he wanted it to be known that he got roughed up. He was out there, you know, spitting blood up, stuff like that, kind of walking weak and everything. Like, he hadn't been acting like that the entire time, but he heard, you know, the Arabic and stuff, and he knew he was around. Right. And those Iraqis, they're terrified of this guy. Because in the city of Fallujah, he was a hero for what he had done in 2004. And, I mean, I remember hearing things that these guys were even scared to put their hands on because, you know, seeking, you know, that their families would take themselves or their families would be killed for that. So, and then Lieutenant O'Neill asked me again. I can't lie. He asked me again. I know you're covering up for somebody, you know, who wants them. And the only thing in my mind was, you know, he had so much attention on that lip and that nothing else. I didn't see anybody punch him in the lip. And for me to you know, throw McCabe under the bus like that, knowing that he didn't do, you know, the damage to the lip.
Did you at any time think any of these guys did anything to his lip?
I can't speak for what happened in there when I was gone, but I don't think they're not dumb enough to punch him in the face.
Okay, so what did you tell NCIS? I thought that before I got back and put my wife's rifle away, one of those guys, three guys did something to El Asawi that caused injury to his lip. Seems to be exactly opposite of what you said to us.
Right. Yeah, it could have hit him, you know, him getting punched. I never saw anything, you know.
Okay, well, what the hell, you're telling us you never saw anything, you had no reason to one of those guys did anything that caused injury to his lip. Why the hell are you saying specifically the exact opposite to NCIS? It seems to me you're kind of making up stuff that's going along here. I mean, you're telling us one thing I have in writing right here. You're saying you specifically told NCIS you thought one of those guys did something to him to cause the injury to his lip.
Right.
That version is true.
The version I just told you.
So this is a lie. You're lying to NCIS.
I never lied to NCIS.
You never lied to NCIS.
You want
to think about that one real clearly.
I'm telling you, you never lied to NCIS. I never lied. What did I lie about?
You tell us. I'm asking you.
I never lied to NCIS.
Okay.
The thing with these statements is, they broke every one of them for me. And they lied to them, right? I signed them and I said it was accurate.
How many statements did you
give?
We have some just, and this is, just
to
make sure we have our stuff straight. How many times did you talk to
NCIS?
Because it was the first statement, right?
There was the first one by Lieutenant Commander Wing. And then there was a supplement one to the Special Agent John Stamp in Ramadi.
And what did you tell
him
that day?
That was pretty much, I just discussed the abuse.
Okay.
I didn't bring anything up about the meeting, stuff like that, because I didn't think that they cared. I thought they were more, you know.
You didn't think it was important?
You know, I didn't think it was important.
Yeah, tell him.
I didn't say anything about the meetings or anything like that.
Yeah.
About it.
You've only given one statement,
NCIS,
and
that's it. No, I gave a statement for the actual abuse, a statement for the cover-up, and a statement for my personal well-being, being threatened. That was it.
What do you mean, personal well-being?
When I got to El Asawi, we had an incident on a convoy where some guy got up in my face. And, I'm stationed in the same city where these guys, where they are too, and it's kind of scary at times.
What do you mean? Is it after all this?
After all of it, when word got around that I had reported it, stuff like that. We got off a convoy, and how I know, you know, I don't know how these guys knew I was coming in on it, but one, you can tell he's a SEAL because he's all big and built and stuff. He came up to me, looked me in the face.
Who's that?
I don't even know his name.
What did he say?
came up, looked at my name tag on my vest, and looked at me and just kind of shook his head. He thought he was pretty heated, and he walked up like a little flight of stairs and was standing there with two other guys, and he was sitting there, you know, just like pointing at me and stuff like that, and then the other two guys were sitting there staring at me as well.
These were guys who said were in PC gear, you had no idea.
They were in PC gear, I have no idea. I think because he was at a different day, it was still Team 10, but they were at detachment head.
What did he even get in your face though? He looked at you and shook his head, right? I mean,
he got pretty close to me, man. It's black, and he got close enough to read black lettering on my vest. So he got close, and I thought, I was like, how you doing? And he didn't.
Okay. Somebody got in my face, it's usually
right,
like the verbal exchange.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
That didn't happen.
That did not happen.
Okay.
What's your impression of feel kind of leading up to this?
I couldn't think any higher of them. You know, I treated those guys, I looked at them like they were superheroes, you know, and they treated me the same. I was never
changed.
Higby
was, you said that he kind of is cocky.
He was cocky, you know, he kind of had a reputation for making stuff up. I never wanted to cross the line with these guys. Just I knew the way they were and stuff like that. I just stayed out of their way, you know. I played like a practical joke on Higby, you know, and everyone got like a big laugh out of it and stuff. We would mess with each other all the time. But,
what was the joke?
He had a patch on his, he'd make fun of me, you know, he had a patch on his uniform, it said one thing, and then I took it off his uniform and put a different patch on, it said something completely different, and he went walking around the base with it, and it was just kind of like an inside joke. But, I mean, it was that kind of relationship where I joke with these guys every day, you know, and I talked to McCabe and Keith every single day. I didn't have any problems with them. I was small talk here and there, but I would actually hang out with McCabe and Keith for...
So you never told anybody that you left the field up there above people? They're
hot
shit?
I don't remember telling anybody that,
yeah.
But I mean, some of them do. You know, but the guys I was with, I always felt so fortunate because, like, after going from SEAL Team 7, where those guys were like that, SEAL Team 10, they were just completely relaxed, and they'd, like, hang out. They would, anytime they could show me how to use, like, a new rifle system, you know, anything like that, they were more than willing to do that.
Okay. Who's the Master Chief for Team 10?
I don't know, Team 10. Team 7, Master Chief Wolfsky.
Team 7 is Master Chief Wolfsky.
Yes, he was the Command Master Chief of SEAL Team 10 and the whole Southwest.
So you were having some sleeping issues over there?
I wasn't having sleeping issues. When I got laid down, I could sleep. It wasn't, but I remember that week before this actual operation, like, I was putting the camera both in. You know, Samina was sleeping, and I had, you know, this one 8 hours a day where I was on the video camera making sure, you know, people weren't setting up orders on us or anything. And I was in charge of the guard force. We had an Iraqi guard in our compound. And then, I had watch from 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was up all day, and there was a point where, you know, when all this went down, I had been up approaching 30 hours.
Was that all preparation for the
op? It was just a mixture of things, you know, it was,
I thought you had lots and lots of downtime.
I did, I had tons of downtime, but I'm not going to prepare for anything for the op if I don't have to do anything, and that's what the whole thing was. I wasn't going to take this guy.
So it was in preparation for you.
What's that?
Why were you working so hard the week before this?
Just because I was responsible for, I had this watch that I hadn't had because we just got this camera system. And then I had to be up for the Iraqis. And it just seemed for like a week straight. I never actually woke up on my own, just waking up to alarm or just waking up. It was someone pounding on my door because every time the Iraqis had to come to the base, I was the one. It was my responsibility to go out there and meet them, search them, and bring them in, escort them in. So I would sleep 3 hours here, 4 hours there, you know, and stuff like that.
Were you on something called a clock watch?
Yeah, and that's another thing. I was on that. I was doing that from 1800 to midnight.
Did you ever get taken off that?
I got taken off that, I think, a couple of days. When I got that new responsibility of watching the camera,
yeah.
they took me off that.
Do you ever talking to what NC went free on Alan Ashton, how you were?
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Nobody knew what would happen. You know, the only guys that knew what happened were the guys involved that had actually seen what happened.
But this is before that, right?
I was never... What?
Do you remember, you were talking about saying that after Samina left, saying that you're stressed out, and that, you know, you're scared because the Marines had left, the security was pretty low.
I wasn't, being in Iraq, your stress levels up just a little Yeah, and that was after it had already happened, but she didn't know.
Okay.
And I wasn't like sobbing, it was just, I was just kind of tearing up.
Okay.
So Frent, I'm sorry, one more time?
Brian.
Frent didn't know about what had happened with the detainee.
No.
Did you tell her what had happened with the detainee?
I almost did, because I went to her for advice. So I couldn't.
Why did you go to her for advice?
She'd been in a long time, and, you know, honestly, I wasn't going to go to a SEAL for advice, or, like, one of the team guys. Cause
well, who were the two people you went to for advice? You make reference to two people for advice.
I went to, I went to you, one Franco, I went to...
Franco and Freeham?
I went to Franco and Mr. Hyde.
Nice.
And then I went to Freeham, but, and there's just, I don't want to make anybody, like, a senior person with security. I don't want to get her in trouble or bring her up on any charges. I don't want to, I already have to watch my back how it is, and I don't want to get anybody else in trouble.
Because, like, I did talk with her.
But she was leaning towards me, saying that, you know, like, things are different in NSW, you know, feel, you know, she just said things were different, you know, and just, no one has to see what you had on that voluntary statement. To do it and go home and live on, go on with your life. And then I pretty much did tell her without telling her. And I looked at her and I said, well, what if I did see something happen? And then she told me then you'd have to report it.
Told the Freeham that?
Yes. That I never came out and told her that I saw McCabe. The only people that I told that I saw McCabe hit him was Ensign Heiss and EO1 Franco.
You mean Lieutenant J.G.?
Yeah, he got promoted to the end.
He's a SEAL or no?
Yes, he's a reserve SEAL. So he wasn't actually a part of the team.
Okay.
But he is a SEAL.
Gotcha.
And I trusted him because...
What was his advice to you?
He was the deciding factor for me, you know, whether or not I was going to report this, you know?
What did he say to you?
He told me that, you know, he wanted, obviously, in depth what had happened and stuff, and I got pretty emotional at this time. And he asked me, you know, is there any way that, you know, was the detainee being aggressive or anything like that? And I said no. I said it was just a punch. And he told me that I was a good person because I told him that I couldn't lie about it, you know. And then he told me that I had to tell Mr. O'Neill what I had seen.
What was the motivating factor for you to tell what you saw him?
The motivating factor was the reality was that I was going to have to make a statement. And I was going to have to go under oath on it and swear to God. Now, I'm a pretty religious person, and, like, to swear to God is something that terrified me as far as lying under it.
So nothing afterwards did have any impact upon you making the decision to,
I mean, there were so many factors. I mean, because the reality is, none of you guys were going to own up to it. And I'm an elite detainee handler. All the questions are going to come back on me. So I was the one that had to turn over the abuse in me. And I was going to be the one that had to answer all these questions, while these people, like the ones that actually did the abuse, they're going to go on with their life. And I knew these guys for 5 months. They're not going to, they would have gone on and lived their life, and I would have been, you know, dealing with the consequences for something that they did.
And you just seem to think that, you know, you acknowledge clearly that you lied, and you were there performing through your duties, and you just think you're going to walk through this thing with nothing happening to you.
That was a concern as well. You know, I figured, I saw this, and I didn't report it. But it was just...
Well, you didn't just not report it. You lied your ass off, too, correct?
I did not tell Lieutenant O'Neill that I lied.
You made a false official statement. Lieutenant O'Neill asked you specifically what happened. You lied to him, right?
I don't lie to him and say that I know what you're getting at. I know what you want me to say. I do. But I was never under oath on any of this. And he asked me, you know, I didn't say that I saw something that didn't happen. I just didn't tell him everything. So I just didn't lie. I just didn't tell him everything.
I know my fault.
I know it's, yeah. And, you know, that's just a risk I had to take because if I would have gone on with the whole cover-up and thing, I mean, I was already in trouble enough for not reporting it.
I understand.
I did not come forward to a superior officer.
What do you mean you were in trouble for not reporting it?
Kind of tell the report. It's a general order, and you know, in the Navy. So there were just so many things in my head, and you know, I just couldn't make the decision fast enough. And that's just how long it took me. It took me 3-4 days to do it. So
you have a girlfriend back home?
No.
What makes you think the Navy's not going to do anything to you?
And they could.
Yeah, you're going to keep on plodding down the road, admitting that you were there.
This isn't something that I wished upon. I didn't tell those Navy SEALs to come back and to rough this guy up. It's something I wasn't prepared for. I never thought these guys would do this to me. And it's something that I have to deal with. You know, and it's easy to sit there and say, you know, sit back and be an armchair warrior and be like, you know, this is what you do in this situation. I can do that right now. I, you know, tell you that I should have stood up and, you know, stopped these guys. You don't do it. It's just the way the community is. You don't step up against these guys. You just don't do it.
But you're doing it now.
I had no choice. It was either go down for something that they did, and that was going to ruin the rest of my life, or, you know,
did you have no offer to protect you if you maintained your silence?
No.
Did you ever ask them if they would cover your ass?
No.
Yeah. How much did you wrote out a statement. Lieutenant O'Neill had everybody in the room, correct?
I'm sorry, he would go back to the
back in the swing. So, Lieutenant O'Neill called the meeting. How many people are in this?
It's Danny's, right?
Danny's, right?
Yeah, the first one was in Danny's.
Danny's,
okay. So you're hanging out in Danny's.
The first meeting. Right. And Lieutenant O'Neill says, give me a statement.
No.
No. What did he say?
I haven't. He said, he told, when we turned him over, he told that's the one where it says, get every team guy up and in Danny's right now. And I mean, I wasn't a team guy, but I knew that I should probably be around there because, it, you know, that was involved.
Mm-hmm.
But my room was probably the closest room to Danny's. And I didn't go in there just because I'm not a SEAL and he didn't tell me to, but I was like, I sat on my stairs right in front of my trailer. And,
so he was up on the
meeting. I mean, not
spotted around in case they needed me. There's no, I couldn't have heard anything. I couldn't have seen anything. The door was shut.
Okay.
But I was around, so I knew that they were going to want me to come in.
Okay.
So I'm sitting out there, and Horace just comes around the corner. And he looks at me and he says, did you get in there and talk to those guys and get Horace straightened out? And I'm like, what do you want me to say? You know, because at this point I was pretty upset. And then that's when I walked in. I walked in, said I'm fucked, blah, blah, blah. We had this conversation, you know. These guys telling me that, you know, gee, there's nothing's gonna happen, you know, we have investigations like this, every deployment, you know, I was investigated for this and that, you know, they're gonna send some NCIS out here, and they're gonna question you, threaten you, you're gonna go to jail for 20 years, and nothing ever comes of it, you know? And then, I walked out again, and I went back and sat on my stairs again. And then, Horace just came back again. And he was like pissed off that I was back there, and he was like, did you get in there and get this straightened out with these guys? And I went back in, and we pretty much just sat there until Lieutenant O'Neill showed up.
Well, while you're sitting there, did you get your story straight with the guys? Did you talk to them?
No, well, I was talking to him, but I was just expressing my concern about the guy said, well, I can get into for this, and it doesn't matter what anybody, what happened, you know, it was going to be on me because he was in my custody.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Because it's either report Navy SEAL guys that kill guys for a living, or go down for it. I mean, that's specific.
What do you think was going to happen if you didn't say anything?
If I didn't say anything?
Yep.
Ultimately, I could have lied about it. We could have gotten away with it. But then I would have had to live the rest of my life knowing that I lied about it. You know, do I care about the detainee? No. For what he's responsible for? But I can't live knowing that I didn't do my job and I lied about it. You know?
What were you going to do? At this point, where were you in the process of applying to the California Highway Patrol?
Right before I deployed, I had my first interview, my first panel interview, and then I was put on hold.
So you had completed the first panel interview?
Yes.
Okay, and you were put on hold why?
Just because I was on Iraq.
Okay. And have you done anything, the interview, this panel interview, how many days did that take?
One.
Did it interfere at all with your training?
No. It was during normal work hour, and I just went through my LPO, and he gave me special liberty.
Who was the LPO?
Reginald Chester, MA1. They were all aware of it, and from time to time, people got special liberty for stuff. We didn't do anything in San Diego. We just went in his office, and we just kind of sat there for a few hours, and we went back.
And so it was on your mind at the time that you're in this room, your highway patrol application is on your mind, you're concerned about it.
The rest of my life on the line. You know, like, what kind of job can I get with a bad contact discharge or something? I mean, there goes a wife, kid, everything I've ever dreamed of is out the window. You know, and that's,
Why did you think that was going to happen to you when you hadn't talked to NCIS yet? And
because Lieutenant O'Neill was reporting.
Mm-hmm.
He came in and he's, you know, Cortez asked, he's like, you know, does the commander still need to know about this? And he said, yes. He said, I'm calling him right now. And it just, you know what, it rolled downhill and I was at the bottom of the hill. I was the only non-CO. If they're going to kick a guy out of the circle, it was going to be me.
Now, O'Neill seemed to genuinely not know who had done this, right?
He did not know. He did not condone it whatsoever.
The second meeting is where he asked to make a statement.
Yes.
So
he didn't ask. It was NCIS came knocking on our door and said there's going to be a detainee abuse violation.
Well, wait a minute now, because my understanding, and maybe you mean straighten me out here, you know, this is the fog of evidence so far. So there was this meeting, you were outside, then the meeting was over, you talked to where it says, he said, get your ass in there, so to speak.
Right.
You go in there, you're talking to guys, you're waiting around. Doesn't Lieutenant O'Neill come back a second meeting? Isn't there a
second meeting, but 3 days later.
Okay, so 3 days later,
right.
Second meeting.
Well, it was on the evening of the third.
Okay, so, yeah, we're not just specific, but 3 days later, second meeting. And it's the second meeting, now what do we got?
What happens? Okay, NCIS wants statements.
Okay, NCIS is at the second meeting.
They're not there. They just sent an email saying that there was going to be a detainee abuse.
Okay, so O'Neill comes in and says, I want
statements. They requested them.
They
NCIS told Lieutenant O'Neill that we need statements.
So Lieutenant O'Neill, in our nightly meetings, he's the one that said, hey, we need statements from everybody.
Oh, okay, so this is a standard nightly meeting.
Every night. It was, I think, it got pushed back to 18:30 by this time.
It was not actually a second meeting about detainee abuse.
Every evening we have a meeting, okay? It varied between 1800 and 1830.
Okay, but you see the difference. You refer to a first meeting in Danny's in reference to the DTI problem.
Right.
Then that makes me think, okay, well, a first, there's usually a what?
A second.
Right. But this was not a second meeting about detainee abuse. This was just a regular meeting.
This is a regular meeting.
The subject of which was providing the statement.
It was just one of the topics that came up.
Okay.
And then after that meeting, then they said, hey, anybody that's involved in this, go over to this room. And we went to a different room, just guys that were involved, and that's when they handed out the statement.
Okay, now
it was two separate meetings. And the other one was just an all-hands muster that we do every day.
Okay.
When the first statements were made, did you see them get handed in to Lieutenant O'Neill?
No.
All right, but you know people made statements?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So he comes out and hands out pieces of paper that you were supposed to write?
Yes, this is a voluntary statement.
Into a volunteer state.
Were there any rights advisement at that point?
No.
No.
So everybody's pretty much ordered at that time to make a statement.
Right. I think the email specifically said they want the master at arms, and then anybody else said that was involved with the handling of them or any around them at any time.
You will make a statement. That's what was basically said, correct?
Right. The NCIS wanted statements from everybody. It's not like that was thrown up as far as I refuse to give a statement.
Now, how about I'm talking to Lieutenant O'Neill. The first statement Lieutenant O'Neill took from everybody. I mean, the word was out, you will make a statement.
He never demanded it. It wasn't really Lieutenant O'Neill demanding it. He was just speaking on behalf of NCIS. Then, hey, I got this email. You know, this is what needs to happen. So I guess he was saying, yes, we have to do it.
There was an email from...
Yeah.
There was an email from the lieutenant. Or from NCIS to Lieutenant.
Yeah. I never thought that there was.
And what did you do to your phone? You took it back to your room and worked on it, or
I was right there with the guys, or what?
I actually never even started writing it.
Never even started writing it, no.
So,
because, where it is, right before in that regular meeting that we do every evening, I'm sitting there watching the camera like I was doing the medical facility, and Cortez comes up to me, and he said, what time do you go to bed? And I'm like, oh, no, he's like, what's going on? And he said, I'll talk to you later. And in my head, I'm like, that was my greatest fear, is actually this thing being uncovered, you know? Because it wasn't a choice of whether or not, you know, I could shut up about it. I had to report it because I wasn't going to lie under oath about it. So he's like, I'll talk to you later about it. And then eventually that kind of stemmed into, he said that he wanted to write my sworn statement. He wanted to be sitting with me when I wrote my sworn statement. And that's when he said that, I was like, man, I can't be part of this anymore because now I don't even have a voice myself. And even if I were to write it, you know, they agreed that they were all going to be collected and reviewed to make sure people didn't put any incriminating information.
So where's his request to write your statement with you?
He wasn't going to write it. He never said he wanted to write it, but he wanted to sit down with me and help me write it.
Okay, so request to be present, to be exact.
Right, right.
That is what actually pushed you over the edge and motivated you to report.
It was just, everything, the reality started setting in, and that, my senses came back to me, and I just knew how to do it, and I kept on praying and stuff, and asking God for advice what to do, and then on the morning of the 4th, I just woke up, and I just felt different about it, and that's when I got, I didn't want to ask anybody for advice, because then, they were committed and stuff, and I didn't want to involve any more people that had to be involved.
We did have 3 people for advice.
MC1,
MC1,
I asked for advice, but I knew what she was telling me,
And Mr. Heiss.
And Eoin Franco.
And Eoin Franco.
And they assured me.